The Courage to Lead, Episode 8.
You're listening to the IB4E Coaching Podcast.
Brought to you by IB4E Coaching, business coaching for executives, entrepreneurs, and small business professionals. Learn more at ib4e-coaching.com.
Hey, Coach Harlan here with the IB4E Podcast. The Courage to Lead. And I have a very special guest for you guys today. General Mark Gellhart served as a colonel in the U.S. Army. And while a lieutenant colonel, he was selected by top officials in the government to be commander of the Data Systems Unit as part of the White House Communications Agency. In that position, he supported President Bill Clinton, the VP, the White House staff, and U.S. Secret Service, managing all classified automation and telecommunications for the executive branch. Lieutenant Colonel Gellhart worked at the White House for over 4 years, working with the president and his staff almost every day, both on the White House grounds and traveling around the world. And this gave Mark unfettered access to the inner workings of the White House, which he took time to write down in his book titled My Time at the Clinton White House, Military Support to the Commander-in-Chief. Since retiring from the Army in 2001, Mark has held several executive leadership positions: Chief Information Officer, Chief Security Officer, Chief Technical Officer for companies like World Airways, Global Aero Logistics, Intercall, TravelClick, and Acting Interim CISO for the Georgia Lottery and NCR. Mark is currently Senior VP of Global Technology Governance, Global Technology Services as part of the Technology Operations Service Team for U.S. Bank and Elavon. And just an impressive resume, Mark, I got to say. Mark is still giving back to his country and his community as a volunteer in the Georgia State Defense Force, a Georgia National Guard auxiliary. Brigadier General Mark Gellhart became commanding general of the GSDF in December of 2020. And Mark, thank you, first of all, thank you for your service. Thank you for your continued service, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. That's an awful large intro for me. I try to be a little bit more humble than that intro shows. But yeah, I've been around a little bit.
Absolutely. No, and just like I said, reading just all the companies you've worked for, all the things you've done, both military life, civilian life, and now as general in the Georgia State Defense Force is awesome. I absolutely want to get into all of that. You're also a world traveler. You and I share a love for travel, so I'd love to talk about traveling. And yeah, just everything else that comes up. But first, as my listeners know by now, I have a series of questions, Mark, that I would like to ask you. These are questions that were made famous on the television show Inside the Actor's Studio. The host, James Lipton, would ask these 10 questions of his guests to let the audience get to know a little bit more about them. And I would like to ask you. So if you're ready, Mark.
I'm ready.
What is your favorite word?
My favorite word. That's easy. So the phrase, that's easy, is my favorite word.
Okay. What is your least favorite word?
You know, I don't think I really have a good answer for that. Yeah, let's move on.
Okay, we'll move on. What turns you on?
Life. Waking up every day, getting out of bed, putting my feet on the ground. When I was in the service, I'd say, put my feet in the dirt.
There you go.
But here in the civilian sector, just getting out of bed, having a positive outlook for a fresh new day, because anything can happen today. I could win the lottery today.
There you go.
I could also get hit by a bus today. You just don't know.
That's right. Life is an adventure. Okay. What turns you off?
People with negative attitudes.
Me too. What sound or noise do you love?
Sound or noise that I love. You know, I love cutting the grass. I love the sound of a lawnmower. I love hearing people out in the yard taking care of their pieces of dirt, their house, their property. So yeah, I love that outside sound.
Okay. What sound or noise do you hate?
So we have these train tracks right down from our house, and there's three cross barriers that the trains have to go past. And train dynamics are you supposed to blow your whistle three times before you cross a crossway of a train track? So during the spring evenings when I have the windows open and fresh air coming into the house, it'll be 2 o'clock in the morning and I'll feel like there's a train coming through my front door of my house. It is so loud. We're on a little hill. So the sound of the train blowing the whistle reverberates into the house and around the house. And it's like I got to open the front door to let the train through.
There you go. Mark, what is your favorite curse word?
I really don't have one. I don't personally myself curse. That's not who I am. That's not how I was brought up. That's not who I've become. So I don't have a thing. You know, shoot is about as hard as I get as a curse word.
So when you stub your toe, you yell, shoot.
No, more like dang it or darn or yeah.
Those are good too. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Well, see, it's hard for me to answer that because you read some of my bio, but it doesn't have all of what I've done. I've been a police officer. I've been a firefighter. I've been a blue collar worker and done construction. I've been in the Army and dug foxholes. I've been in combat. I'm doing IT and cyber stuff. I volunteer in all sorts of organizations. I volunteer with the Civil Air Patrol, fly 172, 182 Cessnas. If there's an occupation out there, I'll do it. I'll be a garbage man. I'll be a welcomer at Walmart. I enjoy life and waking up each day. Give me something to do and make it a productive day. Let me help others. That's all I ask for.
That's excellent. What profession would you not like to do?
Well, you know, I did some things in the service. I went to winter warfare school up in Alaska, where we parachuted in the Mount McKinley, which is now Mount Denali. And we lived off the land for 2 weeks in sub-zero weather, sometimes down to minus 40. I don't want to do that again. You know, whatever profession takes me up to Alaska, Antarctica, any place really cold, I don't want that profession. And I'm not going to do that.
Good job. And finally, Mark, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
It's about damn time you got here. Help straighten this place up.
That's good. Excellent. Good answers. All right, Mark. Appreciate that. And we will be back with General Gellhart right after these messages. So stick with us.
For a limited time only, you can get your hands on my proprietary Roscoe framework, the best damn goal achievement methodology ever devised. Crush every goal, personal or professional, guaranteed. Check it out, ib4e-coaching.com/Roscoe. That's RSSCO, the Roscoe framework. ib4e-coaching.com/Roscoe. Get it now.
All right, we're back in the studio with General Mark Gellhart. Mark, impressive. Like I said, your resume is just phenomenal, sir, and I appreciate your service. Tell us a little bit about how long you were in the Army.
So I was in the active duty Army for 22 years. I started as a second lieutenant out of ROTC, University of Florida ROTC. Came into the service in 1979, and exited the service September 2001, right when 9/11 happened, from my active duty service. Retired as a colonel in the active duty, and then turned around and continued to give back in the Georgia State Defense Force today, which is another form of military service, as the commanding general for that organization as Brigadier General.
That's awesome. And how many troops do you have now for the Georgia State Defense Force? How many members do you have?
The size of the Georgia State Defense Force is around 450. Okay. The Georgia State Defense Force is the National Guard of old. So if you think about the colonies when we started as a country, if you think back to the 1600s, when we had farmers that came to a new land, they would come together both for protection and for community. A farmer would put down his pitchfork and pick up a hammer and help build a church or a school for the community. He would put down his pitchfork and pick up a rifle to protect his community from Indians or hostiles. That came all the way to the Revolutionary War, where the Minutemen, the farmers, put down their pitchforks and picked up weapons against the British to create the United States we know today. That organization, that Minutemen, that State Guard, has become the National Guard. Well, during World War I and World War II, the National Guard was deployed federally overseas, leaving the states and the governors of those states with no uniformed trained force to in time of emergency or need. So I'm not talking about people with M16s walking down the street. I'm talking about a hurricane hitting and no National Guard to help. Well, today the same exists. Today, our National Guard gets federalized and sent overseas to fight in Afghanistan and other conflicts. They have to do national training. So that leaves, again, the governor without the ability of having a uniformed trained force here in the state. My state happens to be the state of Georgia. We have the Georgia State Defense Force, or State Guard. Some people might even say the organized militia, but the word militia has negative connotations in today's world. Right. So the State Guard today is an all-volunteer uniformed force that provides the state, the governor, sheriffs, and local communities a uniform trained force of individuals to support during a hurricane, during a flood, during the vaccines and the pandemics that we've had. The State Defense Force was called to active duty for its longest time in the history of the State Defense Force. We are at active duty for more than 4 months this last year in 2020, during the height of the pandemic, where we operated food banks and helped food banks, where we decontaminated nursing homes, where we helped in many other forms of logistics support and organization skills. The unit did so much last year in 2020 that the unit received the first ever Distinguished Unit Award, awarded to us by the governor and the TAG, the Adjutant General of the National Guard of the state of Georgia, gave the whole unit the Distinguished Unit Citation and ribbon. Wow. So it's really a giving of for your country and for your community.
That is awesome. Yeah, I've got some friends who are involved, and they did spend a lot of time cleaning at the different facilities around during the COVID pandemic. They are deployed to help set up duty stations, different places. You know, like you said, if there's a hurricane, flood, if there's things like that, very, very active. This is awesome. And there's quite a history in the state of Georgia.
The history goes back to the 1600s and 1700s. The State Guard, or volunteers that come to help the state, is an America tradition. Today, there's more than 16 states that have state guards. Every state has different titles in their state constitution that allows for a state guard. Mm-hmm. But right now, there's only 14 to 16 states that actually have active state guards that are doing what we do here in the state of Georgia. We're tied for third place behind California and Texas in size and in mission. South Carolina and Tennessee are tied with us in third place. They have about 400 folks, 450 like we do. And all these different state guards, just like being a volunteer firefighter in your community, or being a volunteer sheriff in your community, or sheriff's auxiliary, or working for the Red Cross, or working for any of these other volunteer organizations for emergencies, the State Guard or the State Defense Force is a volunteer organization where you say, I've got time, I'll go do this. No, I don't have time. Like right now, I have a full-time job, mm-hmm, where I work Monday through Friday for a bank. And yet I'm still the commanding general of an all volunteer force that really works 7 days a week. We have people doing stuff every day.
Wow. That is awesome. And so what is your long-term goals? How big do you see the force becoming, and where else do you see them getting involved?
Well, I would like to grow the force to 800 people. I'd like to double it in size. I'd like to get the word out. One of the reasons I'm doing this podcast with you today is I'd like to get the word out. So anybody in the state of Georgia listening to this podcast, come join the Georgia State Defense Force. If you live in another state and you're listening to this podcast, there may be a state defense force for you. Some call them state guards. Some call them state defense forces. There's a few other tweaks to that name. No one uses the word militia anymore. That's a bad word to use. But these state guards or state defense forces are available in many states, and you can come join and give your time back to your community. You don't have to be prior service like myself. You don't have to have been in and retired. You don't have to have any military background at all. You come in as a civilian because you didn't want to join the military and you didn't want to get deployed to a combat zone, but you still want to give back. You want to experience the military culture and camaraderie. You come join. We will train you. We have initial entry training. We have training on how to put on a uniform. We have training military hierarchy. We have training on what we do, search and rescue, chainsaw operations, setting up deployment operations, called pods, helping the Red Cross, helping the state and the National Guard. And we even have opportunities if you want to go out to the range and shoot some weapons with the National Guard. We have opportunities to do that. We run marksmanship training classes and courses. We have professionals like myself. I'm a cyber guy. We don't quite do cyber, but we have sheriffs. And we have other professionals within our organization that allow us to do a lot of professional training at no cost. Now, there is a cost to join. We'll give you one uniform. You got to buy the rest of the stuff yourself. So it is a pay-to-play volunteer organization.
Got it. Well, like I said, I know some people who are involved. They love the fact that they get to help out. Like I said, there's some of them that either weren't fit for duty at the time when they were going to sign up, or for whatever reasons weren't able to go into the service, but they always wanted to help out, and this is their way of kind of giving back to the community. So I think that's a great opportunity, and we'll get the information on exactly where they can go to find more information at the end of the podcast, and I'll make sure it's in the show notes for everybody too. Your book about your time in the Clinton White House, talk about that. How did you get called up? What was that like?
So I had a very unique military experience. I was not your typical military individual. I was outside the bounds of norm. I actually got one evaluation when I was a younger officer that says, this officer does not always follow orders. That's pretty bad for an officer not to follow orders of the officers above them. But when they're stupid orders and they don't make sense and it hurts the troops, So I made some missteps as a young officer, but those missteps helped me grow and develop to the individual I am today. And I learned a lot from those. One thing led to another, and I was about ready to get out of the service. I had done extremely well in the service. I kept getting promoted faster than the normal individuals. I kept accepting jobs that were atypical. I accepted several classified jobs, did rather well in them. I advanced very quickly, and I got to a point where I looked at myself and I said, do I want to stay in the service or do I want to get out? And at this time, the military, it was after Desert Shield, Desert Storm, we had come back. The government was taking a drawdown of the military after Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and they were offering early retirements. So I looked at that early retirement and I said, yeah, maybe I'll take that. I was here in Atlanta. I had been brought back to Atlanta from Desert Shield, Desert Storm to work for 3rd Army, Army Forces Central Command, which used to be at Fort McPherson. And I was working for a 3-star general. He brought me back. I ran into him in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. He liked me so much that he cut orders for me to move without me even knowing it. And I got orders and I had to move in a week.
Wow.
And ended up coming here to Atlanta and living here in Atlanta. And my wife and I really enjoyed it here. So I was going to get out of the service. And I put out on my network of friends that it was time for me to go. And thank you very much. I was looking for a job. If I couldn't find a job I absolutely loved in the military, I was going to retire. Well, one of my friends told another friend. And finally, an NCO, non-commissioned officer that I helped earlier in my military career. I forced him to become a warrant officer. He was a great individual, didn't have a lot of schooling behind him, didn't have college, but was the smartest guy I had ever met. It's kind of like an Einstein kind of guy. Knew everything. I mean, just absorbed stuff. So I forced him to go warrant officer, and he called me and said, "Sir, I heard you're getting out of the service, and I don't want you to do that. I think you're a good officer. I want to work for you again. Oh, by the way, I'm working at the White House, and I want you to come up here and be my new boss because my boss is leaving." And I said, "Well, the White House. Okay, there's a job that I want to do. I can't refuse that." So I called the Army, and I said, "This is Colonel Gelhart. I was a lieutenant colonel at the time. This is Lieutenant Colonel Gelhart. I want to go work at the White House." And the Army told me, "You're pretty good. You're going to make colonel, you're going to make general. You got a great record, but you're not good enough to go to the White House." And they turned me down cold. And they said, "You're not good enough." And that's one of the life lessons I would tell anybody that's on listening to this podcast. You are the commander of your own destiny. Now, you can let other people make decisions for you, but you really can make a lot of decisions yourself. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the military and you get orders, you got to go with what they say. So the key is to get in front of that decision cycle and help them make the right decision. So I helped the Army make the right decision by not taking no as an answer. So I talked to my friend that was there at the White House and said, "Who's the real decision maker? Who's the person that really can make this decision?" And I got that guy's name. I got his personal phone number. I got his personal fax machine. And I worked out a plan to contact him directly when his secretary was away from his desk. So another lesson for all your readers or listeners to have, do you have your 3-minute, your 5-minute elevator speech? Are you ready with that? So are you ready? Can you sell yourself with a 3 to 5 minute speech? Well, I sold myself. I called the individual directly when his secretary was away from her desk. And how did I know that? The guy at the White House called me and said, "Hey, she's going to the bathroom. Call him right now." So I called him. He picked it up. And I said, "Sir, you don't know me. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Gelhart. I'm in the Army, and I want to come work for you. And I know you have a job for me. If you would give me 5 minutes of your time, I will convince you I'm the right person." He says, "This is not the way it's done, but I'll give you 2 minutes. So 5 minutes later, when I said, "Sir, everything you need to know about me is behind you on your fax machine. I've been faxing it to you while we've been on this call. It's right next to your black coffee cup that's half full from your coffee this morning. You'll find everything." He goes, "How do you know I had a black coffee cup? How do you know it's half full? How do you know what my fax machine number is? By the way, how do you know my private phone number?" I said, "I'm not getting anybody in trouble, but if you hire me, that's the type of officer you're going to get." Well, he says, "Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. This is not the way it's done." Click. So I gave it my all. I didn't let the Army say no. I didn't let some door guardian say no. I went straight to the source to try to convince my life story to a person. And I didn't know whether it worked or not, but I felt good about myself that day because I did all I could do. And then it was in someone else's hand. Well, a couple of days later, my boss, did I mention I worked for a 3-star general? My boss, the 3-star general, got a call from a 4-star general from the Pentagon. Started yelling at my 3-star general about Colonel Gelhart and what the hell is Colonel Gelhart doing down there in your organization. So I got called into the general's office, and he put the phone on the speaker so I could hear this 4-star berating my 3-star about what this lieutenant colonel did. And when he took a breath, my general said, "Well, Colonel Gelhart's in my office, and he's heard everything you just said. Krongard, you have anything to say for yourself? And I turned to the four-star on the phone. I said, sir, what are you talking about? I got no idea what you're talking about. He goes, we got a by-name request from the White House for you to come interview.
Nice.
And my answer is, you did? How did that happen? So take charge of your own destiny. Make your own decisions. Help other people make the right decision. Don't just take it for fact that you're not good enough, that you can't do it. Because if you try hard enough, you can do anything.
Exactly. And no doesn't always mean no. No means it is inconvenient right now, but it doesn't mean give up. If that door is closed, go around to the side door, go in the window, go whatever direction you need to go.
So my book, My Time at the Clinton White House, talks in chapter one about that story. And the other 13, 14 chapters talks about the fun things that happen at the White House that the news reporters don't tell you. They're not sensational. They're just fun. They're funny.
It's not a political book. It's not a slam the office type book. It's just recounting some of the stories of some of the things. And pick one of your favorite stories. Tell us one of the stories.
Well, I could tell you about the time I slammed a door in Chelsea's nose and broke her nose. No, I don't like that one. The time I almost ran over Hillary with the car. I don't really like that one either. The time I knocked President Clinton on his butt. So I had just gotten to the White House. I had been there 30, 60, 90 days. So for those readers that really haven't had a stressful job, let me tell you how stressful it was to work at the White House. I'm not even quite sure I have the right words to articulate the amount of stress working at those levels of government entails. The amount of information, I was a smart guy. I got to the White House. I had made my ranks in the military. I can pick up things pretty smart. But I'm telling you, it's like drinking from a fire hose, the amount of information you have to learn and how quickly you have to learn it. And I'm the type of leader is I don't want to just lead people. I want to know who the people are. I want to know what they do and how they do it. I don't need to be the technician that knows how to change a tire, but I need to know where lug nuts are and how to do the tire and how to do a jack and what's the right tire. I need to know enough that I can look over their shoulder and say, hey, they're doing a pretty good job. So I was learning all sorts of things, and I had only been there 60 days. I hadn't even met the president. My schedule was so packed that I would work 20-hour days at the White House. I'd get 4 or 5 hours of sleep. A lot of times I'd be so tired, I'd just sleep at the White House. I had a room there in the basement of the White House. Hmm. I didn't sleep in the Washington bedroom or anything, but there's a bunker down below the White House, and I had a room in that bunker. And a lot of times I slept at the White House because I worked so long and so hard. Wow. But I was learning my job. I had been there 60 days. I hadn't met the president yet. And one of the things I was learning this particular day was how to do an in-town event. The president leaves the White House, goes to a hotel, speaks at a hotel, and comes back to the White House. Well, every time the president goes somewhere, there is a gaggle of folks that got to go with him. The motorcades are like 20 cars long.
Wow.
Everybody wants to go with the president, the press, the Secret Service, then the communications IT guys, which are the guys that I ran, have to be there. We handle all the audio visual, all the sound, all the lights, because presidential speeches are public record that must be maintained by the Library of Congress.
Okay.
So we have to capture that speech and make sure it is of such quality that it can go to the Library of Congress for hundreds of years of history. So I was given two different tasks at that event that usually a troop for me would have done, but I wanted to learn those tasks. So one of the things you do is when the president pulls into a hotel, he usually doesn't go to the front door and get out of the limo and wave at people like on a red carpet. That's not as secure. I mean, Ronald Reagan did that and he got shot.
Right.
So they don't do that. They take the limo and they come in the loading dock in the back area of the hotel. Well, the press can't see where he's at. The Secret Service, other than the ones right around him, don't know. So you have a radio guy where he arrives saying, Eagle, he's code words, Eagle arrives, Marriott Hilton, or whatever, loading dock. And when he leaves the loading dock area, you get on the radio and say, Eagle departs en route to backstage. So I was there calling Rival because that's one of the jobs you do. And I saw him get out of the car. But as soon as he got out of the car, the guy that was training me pulled me aside and said, hey, we forgot to put the symbol of the president on the podium. We need to go do that. Hey, run down this hallway and go put the symbol on the podium now that he's in the building. I said, okay, yeah, I can. Now, even though I'm a lieutenant colonel and these folks all work for me, I said, yeah, I want to learn. So I go running down the hallway, and these back hallways are all supposed to be cleared by the Secret Service. They're supposed to be kept empty for emergency escape routes. But there were some people in the hallway, and they weren't supposed to be there. And I was on a mission, so I just pushed my way right through that group of folks. There's this tall guy. I knocked him down on his butt, and I kept going. Got to the offstage announce area, picked up the presidential symbol, walked it out nice and calmly, hung it on the podium, showing everybody in the room that the president is soon going to be at the podium. So that, you know, it changes the audience. And the camera people all start turning on their lights and stuff. And then I go back to the offstage announce, and you have these announce cards. And I'm getting ready to do the offstage announce. President Clinton, accompanied by mayor or governor and whatsoever. And they're all phonetic, and some people have some really weird names that you have to call us. So I'm sitting there going over the announce card over and over again. It's the first announce I'm ever going to do. And this guy comes up to me and puts his hand on my shoulder. And I turn around and look at him and I go, that's the president of the United States right there. And I look at how tall he is. He was a lot taller than I thought. He's like 6'3", 6'4". And he's pretty large in stature. I mean, he wasn't fat, but he was, you know, big guy, goes with a big frame. And I'm going, that suit looks familiar. And I'm putting two to two together. And I look over the shoulder of the president, and behind him is the chief Secret Service agent in charge and the staff guy in charge of the event. And the guy that was training me, all three of them, like three monkeys against the wall, laughing their heads off.
Wow.
Because they pulled one over on me. They set me up. They didn't know I was going to knock down the president, but they set me up. The president didn't know anything about it. He comes up to me. You okay? You get done when you need to get done? You seem to be in an awful hurry. So he was a real... and I'm sitting here going, and I'm so flustered, I can't do the announce. So the guy that was training me walks up, takes the card. The president says, hey, let's go. And he does the offstage announce. And I'm just sitting there going, I'm going to get fired. The first time I meet the president, I'm going to get fired. There goes my job. I thought I was hot stop. And here I am. But the president never really said anything about it. And it became a treasured story that people reminded me of over and over my 4.5 years there, that I knocked him down on his butt and was still there. So, but that's one of my favorite stories in the book. There's many more appreciative stories of life and of military members supporting the commander in chief, both the ups and the downs. I was there during the Monica and the Travelgate and some of the other stuff. And I don't speak negatively about any of those events, but I speak factually about causes and effect, how it affects the workers that were around the president, how it affects the tax dollars by the extra money you had to spend that you didn't know about, and some of the other things, along with some really funny stories about me horseback riding with the president because no one else knew how to horseback ride, all sorts of stuff.
Wow. So you traveled the world, right? Anywhere the president went?
Yeah, I was in charge of his Moscow visit. I was in charge of his Beijing, China visit. And both of those visits are in the book, and I talk about some could have been life-changing consequences or international consequences on some of the events that I had the opportunity or misfortune, depending on how you look at life, to be involved in. I traveled with them on Air Force One and on the helicopter HMX-1. I got some great pictures of them all and taken off of the South Lawn. And So it was a real interesting job, once in a lifetime opportunity. And I was asked so often, what was it like to work at the White House? Mm-hmm. Do you have any stories about working at the White House? That I was asked that so many times by so many different people that I got used to telling the stories. But my son, my stepson, didn't hear some of those stories. I got divorced after I got out of the service. I got remarried. I loved my last wife. She did a great job helping me through the service. We came to an impasse in life. I found my soulmate with my second wife. And with my second wife, she came with two kids, a boy and a girl, which are about the same age as my two kids, a boy and a girl. And her son joined the service, became an officer in the service, and he married this gorgeous wife of his that knew nothing about military life. And then one day they were moving from Fort Benning, Georgia to Fort Lewis McChord, Washington State, across the country. And he was moving his own goods and his wife and his car. And I volunteered to help. So we drove cross country 4 days, 12 hours a day. And I was telling stories to his wife the whole time.
Wow.
And at the end of that trip, she turned to my son-in-law and said, hey, did you know your father-in-law, your stepfather did this and this and this? And the kids, all four kids, got together and kind of pushed me into writing the book. So the book started out just as stories for my kids. Mm-hmm. And then when I started passing that around to other people to help me edit it, I found that other people were interested in what I had to say.
Absolutely.
And then I've sold thousands of books since. You can buy them on Amazon. You can buy them from me direct if you want a signed copy. But that's enough about the White House and the books.
That is awesome, though. But your book has done well. You've had a lot of opportunities to do signings, book signings. Talks about your book. And like I said, it is available on Amazon, and I'll have all those links down in the show notes. Now, I do want to talk also about your civilian service, but the title of this podcast is The Courage to Lead, right? What does it take to be a courageous leader? The different types of courage, intellectual courage, moral courage, physical courage, absolutely, disciplined courage. You're in a unique position because you were in the military and as a leader in civilian life, and now you're leader of a volunteer force. How is working with a volunteer force different than your civilian jobs and your prior military? How is it being a leader in those different situations? It seems like it would be more difficult as the leader of a volunteer force, because how do you keep that volunteer force motivated?
So there's multiple different questions in there, but I'll answer the real question. Leadership is leadership is leadership. There is minimally different leadership styles that you need in combat, telling people to take a machine gun nest on the top of the hill. Then there is leadership styles within the civilian sector when budget and money is the driving factor, to leadership styles in a volunteer organization. They're all really the same. What do the individuals under you need and want? And how can you provide what they need in a fashion that meets their needs? It's not about you, the leader. Right. It's not about the person in the front or the back or the biggest chair. It's about understanding the needs and meeting the needs of the mission, the needs of the people. Volunteers come to an organization because they want something. It's not because their wife says, get out of the house, go do something else. No, people join an organization because they want self-worth. Mm-hmm. They want to do something. Now, for some people that join the State Defense Force, they just want to get in a military uniform. You know, they couldn't join the military, and they feel like they've missed something in their life, and they want to understand what it's like to be in the military.
Right.
Well, those folks will probably come join, but only stay a year or two, because the whole what they want gets met pretty quick, and they decide, well, I didn't really want that. how you lead people is find out what they really need. In most cases, so our organization, the Georgia State Defense Force, is one-third retirees, just like myself. I bleed red, white, and blue. I would have stayed in the service longer if financially it made sense. I got out of the service and doubled and tripled my salary. You know, you don't stay in the service because of the money.
Right.
So we have prior service like myself. I still want to give back. Your tax dollars paid me to learn a lot of stuff. I got it. Why not give it back?
Sure.
Then one third of our group is prior service individuals that went in for 3 to 5 years, 7 years, and got out, either because they had to go to combat or because of their wife or their kids, their financial situation, their health situation, or they just decided that active duty pace was not what they're looking for. But when they get out, they don't understand, because usually they're a lot younger when you go in and they get out as a lot younger. When they get older, they realize the camaraderie, the esprit de corps, the mission accomplishment that you get from being in a military unit that you don't get in the civilian world. If you do a great job in the civilian world, your boss gets a big bonus. You don't really see anything more in your paycheck. You work really hard and maybe you'll get a pat on the back or a ribbon or something, but your boss is making millions of dollars. In the military, not so. When you're there, you get the thanks of the people that see you in the uniform, say, thank you. And then one third of the people that join the State Defense Force are true civilians that never had anything to do with the military and want a taste of that life. And those are the same folks that would have joined the volunteer fire department or become an auxiliary sheriff or join the Red Cross. They decide to spend their time with us because what they see in the advertisements or because of patriotism. We get a lot of true civilians just out of patriotism more than anything else. A lot of them couldn't meet the standards that the military set, height, weight, medical. And we'll accept those folks because we know they still have something to offer. We know not everybody has to be a guy that can wear a 100-pound pack and tramp through the forest on a search and rescue. We still need the guy behind a radio, behind a desk in an air-conditioned building. We still need the person that does logistics. We still need other individuals with skill sets. So we take anybody. So when you talk about leadership, it's listening. You got two ears, one mouth. Listen twice as much as you talk. Listen to what they want. Listen to the people around you. Surround yourself with like type of listeners, not like type of people. I want people that disagree with me. I want people to challenge what I say and how I say it and come with a good argument. Good. But after you're finished stating your point of view and I'm finished stating my point of view, the best part about the military, there's only one guy on the top.
That's right. Absolutely. But it seems like it would be, you know, I've been in different positions where I have employees or people working for me. They're kind of motivated because of the money that they're getting. In the State Defense Force, these are volunteers. Do you have people that just say, you know what, I'm a volunteer here, I don't need to take this, and they turn around and walk away? Or, you know, that's what I was wondering about, how to keep them motivated, how to keep them engaged.
Dealing with volunteers, they can walk with their feet at any time. We have no salary for them. The inducement for them to come is for them to get something out of it that they need. If you take that away, if you have a bad apple, a bad leader, he can run away people underneath them. And we try not to do that. We listen when things happen. We have what's called an IG, an inspector general. People can put in complaints. I don't want to work for that guy. I don't want to work. So it's really easy. If you don't want to work for Billy Bob, you're a volunteer, we'll move you over to Susie Jane. You don't want to work for Susie Jane? Great, we'll move you. We will move you around until you're happy. And sometimes that means we have a lot of people in one spot, not enough people in another. Sure. We just got to deal with it.
Sure. Sure.
But in life, it will work out. If someone is unhappy, whether it's in a volunteer force or even in a paid job, most people leave their position in a paid job because of their boss.
Yes.
More than anything else. Because they are not, you know, you ask me, what do I like? I like getting out of bed. I like a brand new, fresh day. I like to be positive. And I don't want to go work for someone who goes, oh, man, this is just another day. I mean, just got to trudge through it. Tell me when it's 5 o'clock so I can go home. I don't want to work for a person like that.
No.
He asked me, you know, you see me in the morning and say, hey, happy Monday. Let's go. What do we do today? How are we doing? And I'll ask them about their wives and their kids and what they're doing on the weekends. And I'll start off every meeting. I will join every meeting 5 to 10 minutes early just to shoot the breeze with folks, to have camaraderie, to do fellowship. That goes in a volunteer organization as it does for a paid organization. Get to know the people. We give so much lip service. And, you know, I've worked for several companies that give a lot of lip service. People are our number one asset.
Right.
Well, why aren't you paying them more? Why aren't you letting them go to training? You know, why are you doing some of these stupid things that are against the people? Well, we got a bottom line. Well, then people aren't your number one asset. Your bottom line's your number one asset. And say that. Yeah. Well, they can't. They don't want to get sued. Right. You know, today we're in a litigated world. So it's actually easier to keep people in a volunteer organization than it is to keep people in today's hot market of, you know, I'm in the technology world. Mm-hmm. People will jump jobs right and left to get more pay, to do more fun things. So it's harder to keep people in a paid world than it is to keep them in the volunteer world. Volunteer world, you tell me what you want to do, I'm going to go let you do it.
That's awesome.
Within some bounds.
Yeah, within bounds, absolutely. It has to help. What types of skill sets or people are you looking for in the Defense Force? Is there an area that you're looking to build up?
So everything. There's no job or skill set that you can bring that we can't use.
Okay.
So we are just like a full army. We have a human resource group. We got a finance group. We've got an operational group. We've got logistics, equipment group. We have a communications group. We have an IT group. We've got medical. We have a whole medical group.
Wow.
That expanded during this COVID stuff. We've got an engineering group that if a tornado or a flood or a hurricane comes through and you got to check bridges, who's going to do that? Well, if we have an engineering group, people that are qualified engineers, we can help do that.
Nice.
We have every type of life skill, lawyers, doctors, chaplains. We have more chaplains in the State Defense Force than I think the National Guard has in the Georgia National Guard.
Wow.
We have more lawyers in the State Defense Force than the National Guard does. That's because a lawyer that owns his own firm can't deploy for 6 months, come back and still have a firm.
Right.
But he can volunteer 1 weekend a month and a couple of days extra in the State Defense Force and still provide that support. Same with doctors. Anybody that owns their own business can't join the Guard or the Reserves because they're going to deploy and that they'll lose their business. So those type of people come join us. We can use all assets, all types, all shapes, sizes, color, creed, you name it. We're equal opportunity across the board. You come in, tell us what you want to do. We'll tell you if we got a spot for you. If we can't come to an agreement, no harm, no foul. But that's not very often. I'll find something for you to do that you'll be happy with.
Absolutely. So as far as courage, what type of courage do you think is most important for a leader?
Moral courage. You've got to know who you are so other people don't make you something that you don't want to be. I'm going to pat myself on the back. I don't do that very often, but I'll pat myself on the back. You will never find a more honest, more red, white, and blue, more upfront person than myself. If I say it to your face, that's the exact same thing I'm going to say behind your face. If I'm talking to someone else about you, I'm going to say the same thing to them that I said to you. If you want a straight, non-diplomatic response, I'm gonna give it to you. I'll tell you like it is. Now, I know how to work politics. I've been there. I was at the White House. I got all that politics stuff. But you've got to be honest with who you are and what you want out of life, so you can exude that to the people that work for you. You know, I tell every single person that works for me, I said, you want to go find another job? Let me know. I'll help you. Yeah. You know, I just had a guy that worked for me for 3-4 years. He wanted to advance. I told him, well, the only place for you to advance in the current situation is to take my job. And I don't plan on leaving in the next year or two. So if you want to advance right now, if that's in your timeline, let me help you. We'll go find you another job. And he was an outstanding employee. I'm sorry to see him go. Yeah. But one of my other employees that works for me, this is the fifth time he's worked for me, because he's gone to go get other jobs. And then he's had other managers. And I actually told him that I was thinking about retiring. He goes, please don't do that. I said, but if I retire, you can have my job. I said, I'd rather have you as my boss than get promoted. That is awesome. So it's all about knowing self, being happy with who you are, and being honest with your people. I hate some of the stuff that HR makes us do in the pay world. Well, you can't tell people that. And I'm going, why not? Well, they might sue you. Well, if you're honest and open, how can you lose a lawsuit? Right. You know, I just don't understand. Well, I said, no, you know, if you don't want me to tell them, don't tell me. You know, sure. Yeah, I've had several people that worked for me that were not up to stuff. And I would sit them down and verbally counsel them and say, hey, you need to improve in these areas. And then a little while later, I would sit down and verbally counsel them again. And then after that, I would write up the counseling statements. Mm-hmm. And then after I write up the counseling statements, if they don't change, then I'll put them on a performance plan. And then I try to fire them. And I had HR actually tell me, well, you can't fire that person because they're, you know, too old, or they're a minority group. I said, no, I can fire them. Here's what they haven't done. I've got it all documented. You know, I've told them over and over again, well, let's move them to a different position. Oh, by the way, I moved them from this manager to this manager, and they didn't do as well in both managers. So, yeah, I hate some of the logistician, the lawyer stuff we got to deal with. Because if you're honest and open and forthright and upfront, and you can look at yourself in the mirror at the end of the day, then be happy with yourself. Be happy with what you know, and what you don't know, go find out. Go learn something new.
There you go. Always love to learn something new. Running up on time, travel. You love to travel. Where's the best place in the world you've traveled that you would go back to if you had the opportunity?
Well, I've been to Hawaii 5 times.
Okay.
We just got back from Hawaii last month. We actually went to Hawaii, took a pre-COVID test, landed, took another COVID test, wow. Changed islands, took another COVID test, but it was worth it. I love Hawaii. Now, why do I love Hawaii? They speak English. They use U.S. dollars. They got military bases there. They got forests, mountains, waterfalls, beaches, and it's warm weather all the time.
All the time.
But I love a lot of other places too. I lived in Germany. I've lived in Saudi Arabia. I've lived many other places around the world, and every culture has some great food and has some great items about that culture that I would like to meld into my life. And one of the best parts about living in the United States of America is we are a cultural mecca. Mm-hmm. There's probably more Chinese restaurants than there are American barbecue restaurants. You go to some of these big cities and you can get to Little Italy, Little China, whatever. We are a diverse cultural mecca of all sorts of stuff. And I love that. I love traveling the world. I've been to all the continents to include Antarctica. Been around the world 4 or 5 times. My wife and I just did Israel and Jordan on nice. And all the religious things. The February before COVID, crammed us into a hold in March, and then we waited a whole year and went to Hawaii. So I'm really having some travel withdrawals.
Yes, same here.
So we're doing some more traveling here around the U.S. that we can, but we found that a lot of places are closed and you can't get in. So we're waiting for things to open up, and then we will travel some more. My word of wisdom, my pearl to anyone listening, is this is how you do travel. When you're young, go to the places that you can't afford that are far away, then pay it off. Don't wait until you're old to go to these places that you can't afford, because then you're too old to enjoy them. Right. We went to Machu Picchu and climbed up the mountain, and there was a 92-year-old lady trying to do that. And we ended up carrying her to get around Machu Picchu. But you know, she says, I've always wanted to come here, but I couldn't afford it. And now she was too old to enjoy it.
Right.
So go to those places you cannot afford to, that are far away, that you have to sit in a plane for 14 hours, and do it when your knees are young and your bladder is young, and go see those places, pay them off, and then go see another place. Don't raise too much debt, but go do those things now while you can, before you have kids. After you have kids, you got to wait until they get up to college, and then you start getting older. But yeah, travel now, see the world, see different cultures.
I think we kind of have this backwards where we work for 40 years, retire, and then start traveling. I think we should, when we get out of college, we should travel for a few years and then stop traveling and work. I think that would be a much better deal.
My son-in-law, my stepson, when he graduated from high school, we gave him a 30-day Euro pass.
Excellent.
Go see Europe. Now you're young. Here's some money. Here's the correct safety parameters to use. Mm-hmm. Go see Europe. Do it now. My daughter's seen the world. My stepson's seen the world. My stepdaughter is in Spain right now teaching English.
Wow.
So see the world, learn a different language.
That is awesome. Excellent. Thank you so much for this. This has been amazing. And I would love to have you back on the show again, because there's so many more questions and areas we didn't get into. But thank you for this and your words of wisdom. Don't take no for an answer. A no is not a no. It just means try another way. Convince me another way. And that's
elevator awesome. Speech ready. You never know. I just dropped on one of the employees that works for someone else. I've talked to him on and off for about 2 years about coming to work for me. And I said, I don't know how I'm going to make that happen. And so I dropped on him today. I need a decision. You want to come work for me? You can come work for me tomorrow. He wasn't ready. And I'm sitting here and I'm going, what I hear from you in your hesitation is you weren't ready. And I've mentored you. Be ready. When's the last time you've updated your resume? If you say more than 6 months ago, you're wrong. Update your resume every 6 months, even if you're not looking for a job.
Exactly.
Best time to look for a job is when you have a job. Mm-hmm. Best time to be ready for the next job is when you have a job. Because if you're in between jobs, you're only looking for that next paycheck to pay the bills.
Right.
So always be ready for that next thing, whatever it is.
Always be ready. Good point. What's next for you, sir?
I'm writing two more books.
Excellent.
One book is How to Manage Your Own Destiny. It's a more in-depth discussion of how I got to the White House. How did I manage my career, my destiny, to get to all the places I've been? I have 10 words of wisdom in that book. So I'm writing that book. I'm writing another book, Atypical Military Career, how I bucked a militaristic system in a non-militarized fashion and still succeeded, using my own tool sets of how I am and who I am, and looked at myself. I did not climb on the back of my troops. I had my troops raise me up because they thought I was good enough to do that for. I'm writing two books. I love speaking. So anybody on this podcast that hears this podcast, you can go to www.markgelhart.com. It's my website. I will come speak at your organization. I will come sell books at your organization. I will come speak at your conference. I have motivational speaks. I have speeches about the White House. I have speeches about the military. I have speeches about IT and cybersecurity. So what's next for me? More books, more speaking. And sooner or later, I think my wife will let me retire from my full-time job so I can do my other full-time volunteer jobs.
Excellent.
Who knows?
Well, when your next books are published, I would love to have you back on the show.
Yep.
Love to have you back. All right. Mark Gellhart, General, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate this. I hope listeners, hope you guys appreciate this. I will have all Mark's contact information, his website, links to his book on Amazon. And he, you said they can get that on your website also?
Yeah, go to markgellhart.com and there's the link to Amazon right there on the front page. Perfect.
That's awesome. I will get that out there. Mark, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Listeners, hope you enjoyed this. If you do or did enjoy this, share this with your family, friends, colleagues, and stay tuned because there's a lot more coming. Coach Harlan saying so long for now.